One warm Saturday morning in August, Henry Huggins and his mother and father were eating breakfast in their square white house on Klickitat Street. Henry's dog, Ribsy, sat close to Henry's chair, hoping for a handout. While Mr. and Mrs. Huggins listened to the 9 o'clock news on the radio, Henry tried to think of something interesting he could do that day. Of course, he could play ball with Scooter or ride his bicycle over to Robert's house and work on the model railroad, but those were things he could do every day. Today he wanted to do something different, something he had never done before.
Those were the opening lines to Henry and Ribsy, and you're listening to Klickitcast. I'm John McCoy.
And I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And we are doing Beverly Cleary's Henry and Ribsy this time. Now, this is what number? The fourth in the Henry Huggins books?
Is it the fourth? The third? The fourth?
The third.
Is it the third? Only the third?
I don't know. We had Henry Huggins. We had...
Henry and Beezus.
I think this is the third.
This is the third, yeah, because... Yeah, they continue after this for three more, but... This is the third. We had a couple of outliers in the middle there where we briefly detoured into the Otis Spofford, Ellen Tebbit's verse, but we're done with that. We've said goodbye to them for forever.
Yeah,
we'll never venture into their neighborhood again.
You know, it was very poignant when we left them off because I just keep thinking about where they must have ended up. Henry didn't really age much until the mid-90s. So if Otis Spofford and Ellen Tebbit's were aging at the same rate, I guess right now they would be entering college.
You were making a lot of assumptions about Otis Spofford, but
well, Ellen would be entering college.
Ellen would be entering college. I shudder to think what Otis would be doing. I said this last time, but I do think it's a shame that we're done with their little sideline story because I think there's plenty of interesting places those characters could have gone that we will never get a chance to see.
But on the other hand, we do return to Henry and Ribsy and to, I think, a very solid book in the series.
Oh, no, I totally agree. I think Beverly Cleary has definitely shown her progression as an author, and I think this is the first book of hers that we get a solid novel out of it, like with a setup in the first chapter and a payoff in the last couple of chapters and a conflict that runs throughout the story. And it's the first book where Ribsy is a central player in the, like, Ribsy's shenanigans actually have consequences in this book.
You know, when I was reading this through again, a bunch of memories flooded back to me from my childhood readings of this book. And what I remembered most from reading this book was that anxiety that Ribsy was actually going to do something so bad there was no going back from it. One of the things that I love about this series, I've said before, is that Ribsy gets to be a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to be a dog that is somewhat unpredictable and doesn't always behave in the way that you would hope he would behave. He certainly gets into trouble, and it's not just simply shenanigans. This time, he gets into some serious trouble.
Right, and we also get to see Ribsy in this book behaving... there's a little dog psychology that comes into play with the garbage can story, where they have to suss out the reasons behind Ribsy's misbehavior. And I think that overall, not just Ribsy, but I think Henry, I think Scooter McCarthy, I think a lot of the characters start getting better rounded out in this book. Scooter stops being just a thorn in Henry's side. He becomes a little more of a character. I feel like the parents get a little more personality put on them in this one. And even Mr. Grumby, you get to learn a little bit more about him just as a guy, like as a friend of Henry's father.
This seems to me like the solid... You know, like if you read Peanuts and somewhere around 1958 or so, all the characters are there.
Yeah,
Shermie is there and Violet is there.
We haven't tipped the scale in the 60s over into the... We haven't lost the cast that we're going to lose yet. So everyone's just kind of in this brief stasis.
Yeah, we'll talk about Mr. Grumby when we get there. I think he's a really well-written character in this book.
And, yeah.
And Mrs. Wisser, who appeared earlier on as a kind of a foil to the kids, also gets a chance to shine comedically in this book.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of good stuff coming up in this one. I would say this book so far has the least amount of what I consider like chaff of all the books so far.
Okay, so maybe we should just jump into it and talk about this. As we heard in the opening, we have a typical Cleary opening from her early books, which is basically that poor old Henry is bored with life and wants to find something interesting to do.
And it's, I would say like all the Henry, the first chapter of Henry books kind of are their own little mini adventure. But this one actually serves to set up the coming plot in a roundabout way. Like it's still kind of a little short story of just like something wacky that Henry does in a way that happens several times throughout this book. In the midst of his adventure, development of the story happens. He rides in his father's car up to the top of, what do you call it?
Oh, like car lift.
The car lift at the lube shop. And that's one of the things that that to me stands out when you look at this book in the modern editions of this book with the modern illustrations. It makes no sense. This is definitely a thing that would not happen in our modern society. A car repair shop owner allowing a child to ride in a car in the car lift is just beyond dangerous.
And when they're talking about a lube job here,
yeah.
I don't think they're talking about changing the oil. They're talking about actually lubricating the suspension. Which,
yeah, because you hear him use the lube gun.
No one does that anymore.
Right. And it's actually a hand-cranked car lift as well. He puts the car on there, and then the guy's like, "You ready?" And then he cranks the car up with like by hand. The illustration in my modern edition is a very modern car and a very modern-looking repair shop. The perspective is way off, by the way. In case you're wondering, the perspective makes no sense. So this is definitely a slice of life from a bygone era.
We've talked about this before, but if you at all can get your hands on a copy of the book with the original Lewis Darling illustrations, do that. Because Lewis Darling also, I think, comes into his own in this book. There's a lot of very strong illustrations, and as I was looking through it, I was thinking about how Lewis Darling sort of sits on the fence between Art Deco, and I think his pen and ink drawings remind me a lot of, say, Rockwell Kent in the 40s, or someone like Robert Lawson, who was also producing books around this time, and then moving into the 1950s. It's a real snapshot of its time, the way that these books are a real snapshot of their time. And I wish that the publishers would acknowledge that. I don't know. What do I know? I don't know anything about selling books. And perhaps the publishing house is on to something, that kids have no interest in reading books that they see as too historical. On the other hand, American Girls books sell gangbusters, and those are specifically marketed towards a time period.
Well, I think it's a reflection also of illustrators of the era. Like, you weren't just a children's book illustrator. Like, you were illustrating for magazines, you were illustrating for ad copy, you were illustrating, like, they all came out of that sort of like that same school of illustration where you weren't just drawing children's books. You developed a style that could work in many different avenues. And I think that Lewis Darling's illustrations, you could see his drawings of kids on a Tylenol ad, or on a, or whatever that you hit at the time, Bayer aspirin ad, or they seem to capture something beyond telling the story of a children's book.
Right. And they're also just beautiful black and white line drawings from a time where you couldn't actually expect there to be high quality photographic reproductions of continuous tone drawings.
Mm-hmm.
So it was important to get it all really crisp and bold and graphic. And I love art by people who had to work within a certain set of constraints and did it just really, really well. The other thing that's introduced in this beginning chapter is this Woofie's dog food jingle. I'm not sure what I think about this, to be honest. The Huggins family is listening to the radio and they hear this Woofie's dog food jingle. And at several points throughout the book, Henry sings this jingle, and it's supposed to be a kind of a thematic refrain. What we're supposed to come away with this is the radio announcer says, "Is your dog a member of the family?" And Henry says, "Yes, he is." And almost immediately the parents say, "Well, you know, he does get into trouble a lot." And I suppose that that marker, that refrain of repeating this jingle over and over again, is supposed to be about Henry's anxiety about Ribsy's place in the family. And he sings it at points where he feels like Ribsy has cemented his place in the family. But I feel like she's reaching for effect here.
Yeah, it seems like it's set up. To me, it seems like it's set up so that it can come back at the end. Because it does. At the very end, it's like the last thing we see in the book. And, I mean, it's clunky. It doesn't, to me, tie into the major themes of the story. But it's vaguely cinematic. It's there. It's something to hang on to. It gets the parents talking about Ribsy. It's something that... It triggers a conversation about Ribsy at the beginning of the book so that when the father mentions Ribsy's behavior later on in the chapter, it doesn't come out of left field. Like, this is something that we've already been talking about, is that Ribsy's a good dog, but he tends to get into a lot of neighborhood trouble. And I think, personally, I find it a little crafty on Beverly Cleary's part, because I think once upon a time, Ribsy would have been forgotten about until he needed to be talked about. And I see Beverly Cleary working as a writer to establish these things ahead of time, like putting a little more forethought into laying out the chapter.
Right. Now, the trouble that Ribsy gets into this time, as we mentioned, Henry has gone up on a car lift. He's basically put into a position where he cannot do anything. He's there for the long haul while this lube job is going on, and that means that Ribsy is down and unattended, and he watches in horror as Ribsy steals a policeman's lunch.
Ribsy can get into a police car because a police officer has sort of left his car just open outside a store, and the dog got in and stole his lunch. And to me, again, this is not a modern day story. Like, this is a small town. But even in a small town, like, a police officer wouldn't leave his door open. Like, it's a different era. And Ribsy steals his lunch. Now, before Ribsy has stolen the food, though, Scooter McCarthy has come by.
And there's a little bit of humor there where Henry pretends to be a ghost.
Right. As believable as that is. I guess it does speak to the fact that going up in a car lift is an unusual thing, because Scooter doesn't even think to look up. This is where Scooter brags about having gone to catch fish, to go salmon fishing with his father. And Henry has to admit that he's never gone fishing with his father. He does say that he's gone fishing. He pulls an Ellen Tebbets, where he doesn't lie. He lies by omission in bragging about his experience as a fisher person.
My dad was and continues to be a big fisherman, and I used to fish with him in the Upper Peninsula. We would do lake fishing, which was mostly for perch and walleye and pike. And I read this book and I became enamored with the idea of going out and catching a salmon myself. And I asked my dad, why aren't we catching a new salmon? And he had to explain to me that salmon were not to be had out in Michigan. And it's funny to me because as a kid, I read these books through and I never had a strong sense of their being set in Oregon.
Right, right, right.
And now that I'm an adult, all I can see is like, oh my God, there's so many things that mark this as happening in Oregon. But as a kid, you know, I didn't have any context for that.
Yeah, looking at it now, these are exceedingly region-specific books. But most of that detail, I think, just went over our heads as kids and was supposed to probably just go over our heads as kids. Like, it's there if you know the area, but it wasn't vital to understanding the story. We weren't big into fishing. I went fishing a few times as a kid, but it wasn't something that I did with any regularity or that any of my friends did with regularity. We didn't have the lakes.
So this does set up this desire of Henry's to go salmon fishing, partly to spend time with his dad, but also because it's a marker of maturity. This seems to him to be that one of those hurdles to get over on his way to adulthood, because only adults go out and fish for salmon. And he's very excited by all of the things that seem bothersome or troublesome about fishing, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, going out and being in the rain and the wind for hours and hours in absolute silence. The bit with the police officer just kind of ends. It doesn't really...
It does have a moment in it, though, that every time I read it, I have to stop and be like, this is crazy. It does have the line, "Don't shoot," begged Henry. "Please don't shoot my dog."
Right.
Where Henry thinks the policeman is reaching for his gun. And the policeman, this is before Henry has revealed himself to be hiding in the car. The policeman has returned. And Henry says, "I'm up here. Please don't shoot my dog. I know he shouldn't have stolen your lunch, but please don't shoot him." And it's a weird moment to me. I don't believe it's out of place. Henry just misinterprets what the police officer is doing, and the policeman's like, "Whoa, I'm not going to shoot your dog. I'm just trying to get my lunch back. He wasn't reaching for his gun." But it's a moment of danger. It's a dangerous moment in this book that actually. At the end of the book, there's another moment of danger with Ribsy. And this is the first time, I think, that we've seen Henry... There's something about a child's relationship with their dog. I haven't seen this aspect of it again. Like, he loves Ribsy. He enjoys Ribsy. Ribsy's his dog. This is the first time we see Henry fearful for Ribsy's, like, life. And reacting like a kid would. Like, this begging like a child would. To save his dog, to please don't hurt my dog. And it's a very human moment to me it comes out of nowhere, but I also appreciate it being there because I like seeing Henry's concern for Ribsy at this like very visceral, very animal level.
I agree with you, but I would also say there are several points in this book beyond that where there's sort of an existential question about whether Henry is going to be able to keep Ribsy.
Oh, right, right.
And it keeps coming up and up again. And reading the book through reminded me of the amount of anxiety I felt reading this as a child. And I think that Cleary is very good at making things important to kids that are important to kids. And you don't really, when you're a kid, you don't really know what the rules are. You don't really know what human nature is. So when you're dealing with grown-ups, particularly grown-ups that aren't your parents or that aren't your teachers, you aren't exactly sure what's going to happen. And you recognize that they have authority, that they have power that you don't have. And so it becomes very worrisome. And that will come up with the garbage episode.
Right,
it will come
right.
With Mrs. Wisser. It comes up throughout the book, I think.
It'll be interesting to track that throughout this because the central conflict is presented as keep your dog. So Henry asks his father, you know, "Can I come fishing with you next time you go?" And his father makes a deal. He's like, if you can keep Ribsy out of trouble for the next, how many weeks is it? Like, it's like 6 weeks.
It's a long time.
It's a long time, especially for a kid. If you can keep him out of trouble with the neighbors, then yeah, I'll let you go fishing with me, or I'll think about it, or whatever. And Henry's like, it's no problem. It's only a few weeks. Not even taking into consideration the fact that every single day Ribsy is doing something. So that's presented as the central conflict: is Henry's got to keep Ribsy under guard so that he doesn't get in trouble and ruin Henry's fishing trip. But what ends up happening, as you pointed out, is that Ribsy starts getting into trouble and it starts actually threatening Ribsy's well-being. And that becomes, and I hadn't even noticed this until you said it, the real concern over the top of the possibility of the fishing trip becomes, is my dog going to be taken away from me? Like, is Ribsy going to do something so terrible that the neighborhood will misunderstand the kind of dog he is? And remove him from my house.
Let's move on to the garbage episode.
Yeah, which is the first, like, big Ribsy pulls a no-no and has his place in the Huggins household threatened.
Henry has been given the chore of taking out the garbage. Again, a marker of more responsibility, but not one that Henry wants.
No, and also a marker of the era in that everyone keeps their garbage in their neighborhood in large metal garbage cans that fill to overflowing as the week progresses.
Yeah, they don't seem to line these cans with anything. They're just kind of like full of garbage.
And these are Oscar the Grouch garbage cans. Like, they are just metal. You just dump everything in there loose, and it just becomes this just sort of soup of decomposing trash.
If you look at the pictures by Lewis Darling, there's a picture where Henry is taking out the house trash to the outside garbage can using a bucket.
Yeah.
It's like a bucket of slop almost.
Yep. It sounds like they have a trash can in their kitchen that has a removable bucket on the inside.
Yeah.
And they take that outside, remove the lid from the garbage can, and just slop it on in.
Yeah.
And which is disgusting.
It is. And it's sitting out there. It's getting rancid over time. So Henry has this new job, and Ribsy accompanies him taking the trash out, which leads to the problem, which is when the trash man comes to pick it up, Ribsy out and out attacks him. He doesn't actually bite him, but he growls and he jumps, and the trash man has to stick the garbage can in between himself and Ribsy to avoid being hurt.
Probably one of the more strangely dynamic Lewis Darling drawings.
Exactly.
Which, it's a weird drawing in that it kind of shows that Lewis Darling didn't quite understand the anatomy of a dog jump, because Ribsy's legs are in a very static position. It's hard to explain, but it's an unusual drawing. But it does capture the ferocity of Ribsy's attack. Like, Ribsy is definitely on the attack, and the garbage man is definitely caught off guard and doing his best to get away from this crazed dog.
Right. Now, the garbage man has, like, on a little like a little pork pie hat, and he's got like a cigar and a spotted handkerchief sticking out of the back of his trousers, and he looks like he's out of Central Casting from like 1935 or something. I don't know. It's really kind of hilarious. Everyone should look up that picture.
Yeah, don't look up the new picture, in which it's a modern garbage truck, modern garbage man, and the children are carefully drawn with bicycle helmets on. Like, they're literally, it's like, gotta make sure we know where we are.
You mentioned the children. That's important. Scooter and Robert. Is it Robert there?
Robert and Scooter, yeah.
They see what happens, and they're horrified by the fact that Ribsy has attacked the garbage man.
And Scooter immediately goes on to the position that Ribsy is an out-of-control dog, that Ribsy is a wild dog that everyone should be afraid of, because that's Scooter.
It is played as sort of a mystery throughout the chapter as to why Ribsy would go so crazy. And it's also played for kind of some gross-out humor that the garbage piles up for another week.
Right, because the garbage man has left without taking the garbage.
Right.
And now everyone's kind of in a fix because the garbage keeps piling up, and his parents refuse to get another garbage can, and it's stinking so bad that it's like the smell is spreading around the neighborhood.
Right, and Mr. Grumby, the next-door neighbor, comments on it, and he also comments that he's heard the story that Ribsy tore the seat out of the garbage man's overalls. So the story is spinning out of control.
And then it eventually spreads that Ribsy actually bit the garbage man.
It's not simply that the fishing trip is in danger. Ribsy's very continued existence here in this family is in danger if he's deemed a dangerous dog.
Right. They say something about, I can't remember where it is, but he says something about, like, he knows what happens to biting dogs. They get taken to the pound.
Yeah.
And that's a real threat. Like, that's something that kids worry about.
Right.
Well, eventually the garbage can gets attacked by neighborhood dogs because it's filled with food.
Right. And we have, again, these roaming packs of dogs.
There's the roaming neighborhood dogs.
What is it? There's like a collie and another dog.
The collie, yeah, it's two big dogs. One of them is a collie, and it just, I think it says a collie and another big dog.
Right.
And yeah, they're rooting through the garbage. They've knocked the garbage everywhere so bad that Henry's father has to help clean it up with a shovel. And what's funny to me is that it's presented as Henry's problem. Like, well, you're in charge of the garbage, so this is your thing to deal with. But as a homeowner personally, to me, like, this is everyone's problem now. Like, I feel like the parents should address this with the sanitation department, or they should buy another garbage can or do something, because it's out of control. Like, it's a public eyesore, it's a nuisance, and it's upsetting the day-to-day. Like, everyone's like, what are you going to do, Henry, if the garbage man never comes back? I'm like, no, what are the Huggins is going to do? Because this is their life.
But I do think that this is similar to other Cleary stories in that the parents really want to put the responsibility on the kids, probably as a sort of a teachable moment here. It ties in again with the amount of responsibility and freedom that these kids have in the 1950s. I remember other stories like this. If you read like the Henry Reed books, mm-hmm. or the, what were those books about? Oh, shoot. I'm forgetting the guy who had the... Well, never mind.
Did he have an incredible donut machine? That was Homer Price.
That was Homer... Well, Homer Price, definitely. Those were set in the 40s, I believe.
Yeah. That was pre this.
But that's a good example, too, of kids just getting into all sorts of crazy adventures because they were unsupervised. But as you say, in this case, the grown-ups should be supervising.
Right.
But...
I mean, all I know is that if I let my garbage get that bad, I'd get fined.
Well, there's a lot of things that people would get fined for. Right. You know, dogs running free, kids going up on car lifts, yeah. No one wearing helmets.
This entire book is a legal nightmare.
And little Ramona showing up later with like a pound of butter that she eats.
That's amazing. I can't wait to get to that. But at the moment, Ramona does show up, and she starts tormenting poor Ribsy, like physically tormenting the dog, proving that Ribsy's not just a vicious dog. Like, that's an important little point, is that Ramona's beating up on the dog, and Ribsy's just kind of taking it. And it, because everyone's getting kind of worried that maybe Ribsy's out of control, but they're like, no, look, Ribsy's doing fine. Like, he's just being good old Ribsy. And it's not until Scooter is asked to take a look at Henry's bike horn and take a look at Henry's bike that Ribsy becomes vicious again. And it's when Scooter is wheeling Henry's bike out of the garage. And that's when Henry puts two and two together that Ribsy isn't out of control. Ribsy is simply sees the garbage as Henry's property now because Henry's in charge of it. And Ribsy is simply trying to protect Henry's property by keeping everyone else away from the garbage. Which is funny because it also gets Henry out of having to take out the garbage.
Yeah, this is another one of those moments in these books where Henry just kind of through dumb luck gets everything he wants.
Yeah, it's a little less dumb luck than I think in the past. Like, he doesn't want to do it. And he does trade it for an equally arduous job. Like, he trades it for trimming the lawn every week, which involves him being down on his hands and knees, literally trimming it with scissors. So he doesn't get out of responsibility. He does have to take on another job. But I do think it's a little shrewd on the, like, the parents understand that, well, Ribsy's being Ribsy, and there's really nothing we can do this time to untrain this dog. Ribsy's not going to be hauled away to the pound, and yes, your fishing trip is still a possibility.
The next chapter, Henry gets a haircut. I remember as a kid really enjoying the comedy of this. As an adult, I'm reading this through, and I actually feel it's a kind of an odd chapter in that it doesn't fit in thematically in a way.
And it's two chapters long. Yeah, it's two chapters that tell this one inconsequential story. The best thing I can think of for this chapter is that it does fill out the parents' personalities a little bit.
You see glimmers of the kind of acute psychology that will come to the forefront in the Ramona books, insofar as up till this moment, the parents have just been parents. They've been completely blank mom and dad. Here we have a little bit of banter back and forth between the mom and dad here, but also later there's a moment where when they get to the fishing trip where the mom announces that it's her vacation.
Yes.
Which I think is a little window into sort of the dynamic between the Hugginses. And also the way that relates to the way that the trash chapter happens, because the mother announces that she's tired of taking out the trash, and father puts down his newspaper and turns to Henry and says, "Your mother says she's tired of taking out the trash." As a kid, the humor of that scene completely, I didn't get it all. Now I think, oh, this is great. As a parent, I know this so well, that moment you're just screwing with your kids' heads because it's so fun to screw with your kids' heads.
Well, this whole chapter, this whole story, these two chapters, are Henry's parents first screwing with Henry. Like, they're being jerks. Like, they are consciously being jerks to their own son for their own amusement. And in the second half of it, the back end of it, Henry's mother deliberately being a jerk to the other kids in the neighborhood to help out her kid. It's not quite Ramona's parents, who are much more grounded and down to earth and far less sitcom-y than this, but it's very cute to watch them aggravate Henry on purpose to the degree that it almost ruins his social life.
What little plot there is basically involves the mom buying a pair of discount hair clippers, expecting to save some money on haircuts, and Henry is going to be the guinea pig. She's not going to do it to the dad.
Because his hair is too valuable.
Right, his hair is too valuable.
As he says, she says. He's like, no, it's too. Your dad's hair is too important. I'm going to do this to you, and I'm going to do this to you right now. Like, there's no practice. There's no, like, she doesn't take a second to get used to the trimmers. She sits Henry down, wraps a sheet around his neck, and gets to work.
Yeah. Now, my mom gave me haircuts when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just with scissors. She did an okay job. I mean, there was a time there where it really didn't matter much what the quality of your haircut, because in the early 70s, every little boy had some variant of a Beatles haircut.
Yeah.
And so that was pretty easy to do, although I'm sure it was a little raggedy and uneven.
No, I remember my mom announcing when I was a kid. She said, "I'm going to cut your hair from now on. I've watched the people at the barbershop do it enough. I know what they're doing. I can do this." And she did. She cut my hair for years. And it wasn't until I protested finally, because all my friends were getting their hairs cut at the barbershop.
I think it was somewhere around the early 80s when hair got way too complicated. Everyone was feathering it and stuff that my mom let me...
Well, I never asked my mom to feather my hair, but I did get embarrassed that my friends were getting their hair cut. Now, my actual story about this is, the parallel here for me is that in college, I bought a pair of hair clippers and announced to everyone that I knew how to cut hair and that I could cut hair. So, it came with a VHS tape on how to cut hair, which I watched once. And so I actually had people say, "Oh, we heard you cut hair." And like, just I would take them into the bathroom in the dorm and I would give them a trim. Terrible job. Like, just absolutely nightmare. But for a college student, it was cheap. Like, I didn't ask people to pay me anything because I was having too much fun. And it all came to a crashing end when a student director asked me to cut the hair of a cast member who needed a haircut before opening night.
Oh, no.
And she was like, "I hear you cut hair." I was like, "Yeah, I cut hair." And she's like, "Well, I'm going to send so-and-so to you so you can give them a trim because they need a haircut before opening night." And I was like, "All right, send them on up." And I did such a bad job. I somehow cut a square into his hair above his ear, like a solid, like three-sided, like right angle square above his ear, down to the skin, and had many an oops moment as I was doing it. And that was the last time anybody ever asked me to cut hair. But I know reading this chapter reminded me of that so much, because Henry's mom starts off super confident. She's like, oh, this is easy. And then, like, within a minute, she's saying, oops, oh no. And she's trying to fix what she did. And it's just, it rings very true to me.
And also ringing very true is the fact that when Mr. Huggins comes in, he has a go at it too and screws things up worse.
And they just start laughing. Like, it just becomes a big joke. Like, Henry is upset at what is happening to his hair. And his parents are back there laughing like a couple of, like, sweethearts. Oh, this is what they're like as a couple. They're jokey and they enjoy other people's misery.
Henry goes to find a hat to cover this up, and he tries on first a Daniel Boone hat, and then he tries on a sailor hat. And I had to laugh about that, because that's another thing. Just imagining kids having a set of these. Does he also have, like, a top hat and a wizard hat? I don't know.
He definitely has a cowboy hat.
He must have a cowboy hat.
In this era. I had a sailor hat in high school that I wore Henry Huggins style because I was in a production of South Pacific. And so for a while, the cast member guys, this is the stupidest thing I've ever said out loud, the cast member guys all thought it was, like, really cool to wear our sailor hats around. It wasn't cool. Anyone listening to this who's young and in theater, it's not cool. Like, don't wear your sailor hat around. Don't, even if it's turned inside out like Henry Huggins, it looks, I look like an idiot. And it's unusual looking enough that Henry wears it and his friends are like, why are you wearing your sailor hat like that?
Because he pulls it down looking a little bit like Gilligan.
Yeah, he pulls it down Gilligan style. Yeah, and he's already played a plot-specific game of tug-of-war with Ribsy.
The other inconsequential thing that is mentioned here is that he's got two teeth that are loose,
mm-hmm.
his canine teeth, and the kids spend some time discussing ways to remove teeth. I don't remember spending much time discussing my teeth with my classmates when I was losing teeth.
Well, loose teeth were always kind of a fun thing. Like, if you had a really loose tooth, like, I remember showing off loose teeth and, like, having friends who showed off loose teeth. But the concept of pulling teeth, by the time I was a kid, was, like, you didn't do that. Like, you understood, like, let's get this out of the way right now. Yanking your loose teeth out of your mouth can really damage your gums. Like, it's a dangerous thing dentally to do. And I think the fact that Mary Jane is there, and she says that, like, my dentist says that if you leave your loose teeth in too long, then your permanent teeth will grow in crooked. Obviously, there were notions about children's teeth at this time that have since been disproven.
So you didn't ever do the thing where you tied a string around your tooth and the other string to a doorknob and slam the door?
God, no. That's horrible. Like, just the thought of that. The thought of it would pull your tooth out in the wrong direction and it could rip your gum up. Oh, it just makes my mouth hurt thinking about it. Did you do this?
Yeah, sure.
Did you do this? And my question is, and this is what always confused me, how do you tie a string to a tooth?
Oh, you use, like, a really thin string, like a piece of thread.
It just seems like more trouble than it's worth.
You floss it through and then you just tie it around. It works.
Why would you do this? Like, what is the, what do
Everyone
you gain?
Everyone was doing it, Phil.
No. I never knew a kid who did the, on a doorknob? It's pulling it at such a weird angle, too. That's horrifying.
I don't know why the doorknob was, but I think it was just you needed to kind of come up with something that had a lot of heft behind it, so it would pull with a sharp,
I guess,
sudden force.
Yeah, and I guess, like, if you slam it, like, there's no going back. Like, it's not like you can't stop it once it starts. Like, you just slam the door and it's fast.
Yeah, a lot of kid lore is about getting things over with, you know, about pulling the Band-Aid off as fast as you can.
Hey, I got a better idea. Don't pull your teeth out. They'll fall out eventually. That's what they're made to do. They're literally, for year, like, millennia, human teeth have fallen out of their own accord. Like, you don't have to coax them out. Like, they're just there. They just the bottom disintegrates and they just fall off.
Well, this has been the Toothcast. And now to return to Henry and Ribsy, this is where Ramona and Beezus show up, and Ramona is eating a pound of butter.
This is disgusting. Like she's holding, she's not just, she didn't get sent out of the house with a pound of butter. They're returning from the grocery store, and Ramona's been giving the pound of butter to hold because you can't break it, which makes delightful sense to me. But right. While they're discussing the tooth pulling, they look over, and Ramona has unwrapped the butter and is just eating it with her filthy hands.
Now, again, another thing that makes absolutely no sense in this day of butter coming wrapped in quarters and in little boxes and stuff. The way it's described, she has like a parcel, like a little wrapped parcel of butter.
Well, that's how we buy butter.
Oh, yeah?
Well, okay. That's how Alana buys butter. I buy butter in sticks. She buys fancy butter that comes in a pound, just a block of butter wrapped up. Like it's not divided into sticks. And so like it wrapped in wax paper. So that's exactly what Ramona has is what she buys at the store.
It's just hipster butter, man.
It's hipster butter. It's so good, though. Man, you use good butter in something, I'll pull out a million teeth to eat that.
While Ramona is eating the butter, Ribsy wants a piece of that butter, too.
And it's another one of those things where they're trying to get food away from a filthy food away from an animal, presumably to you. Like, it was just like the steak from the previous books. We're like, just let it go, man. Like, once the dog has licked it, just let it go. Like, it's done.
Yeah. Well, in the confusion and the distraction, Scooter yanks the Gilligan hat off, and the kids get to see what Henry's mom hath wrought. And so we end the chapter with Henry dejected, slinking home.
And then pick right up at dinner.
That's the only point in the chapter where Ribsy does something that affects the plot. And it feels kind of like Beverly Cleary is doing it in a sort of a pro forma way, because she's titled this book Henry and Ribsy, and she needs to get Ribsy involved.
Yeah, this is the part that feels the most like an older Henry Huggins book. Like, oh, right. We've got to work the dog in because that's the draw.
As you mentioned, the resolution of Henry's humiliation comes about when Henry's mom, hearing that Henry has been shamed by his classmates, makes a few phone calls.
Yeah, cool, because one thing we didn't mention is that school starts in like 3 days.
Yes.
And Henry is going to be humiliated by having this, and it's a terrible haircut. Like, it's a chopped up haircut.
Right. And so Henry's mom says, oh, I can fix this, makes a few phone calls. And then when Henry shows up to school, along come Scooter and Robert, and they're also wearing sailor caps with the rims down.
I guess it makes sense, but it's also funny to me that, like, A, they all own sailor caps, and B, wearing a sailor cap down around your ears is like shorthand for, yeah, I got a bad haircut. Because they didn't have to wear sailor caps. Like, they could have figured out something else, I'm sure. But, like, to me, this is, like, it's funny because this is their neighborhood, like, symbol for mom gave me a bad haircut. And they blame Henry for it.
Because Henry's mom has told their mothers about this sale on clippers. Everyone in this neighborhood, the haircut mafia is just ripe for disruption. They're just paying too much. I guess, what, 50 cents a haircut back in the...
But and these clippers weren't cheap. They were like $7. I think it's funny, though, that Henry's mom was able to arrange this. Like, she obviously didn't get on the phone and say, like, hey, everyone, will you please give your kids terrible haircuts? She got on the phone and just said, hey, everyone, like, clippers are on sale at the drugstore. And they all rushed down to the drugstore and that night, like, gave their kids terrible haircuts. Like, it's this unreal power that Henry's mother seems to have. It worked out perfectly. Like, and I have to assume there's more kids with bad haircuts, too.
What if Scooter's mom was able to give a good haircut? You know, then it would all fall apart.
Not everyone's going to be as bad as Mrs. Huggins. Or not everyone's going to end up, like, wrangling over a pair of clippers with their husband. They do say something to Henry. They accuse Henry of telling his mom to call their mothers, which Henry had no idea this was happening at the time. And one thing Scooter says, it kind of struck me. Henry says, what do you mean it's all my fault? And Scooter says, you know. And if you ask me, it was a pretty mean trick, as bad as tattling. To me, that's one of those beautiful kids moments. Because to say doing something is as bad as tattling on like the list of kid crimes is up there with murder.
The response that Henry gives is, "Cross my heart and hope to die." And that's good enough for Robert. He believes it immediately.
And there's some back and forth about friendship where like Henry's like, you know, that's a real, you're some friend to accuse me of doing something like that. Like it's a Scooter in the first book was presented as kind of just this older kid who would just pick on Henry. And by this book, he's being presented more as one of the friends. He's still a jerk, but there's an understanding that they are friends.
The way that everything gets smoothed over is Henry comes up with a novel way to pull his teeth. I think in a lot of these books, there's a conflict, and Henry's solution for the conflict is to come up with a distraction. And the distraction here is he decides that Ribsy's going to pull his teeth because, as you've mentioned before, we've set up this tug of war that he's been playing with Ribsy, and he ties that rope to a smaller string, which he ties around both his teeth. And basically they tug and the teeth come out, and this smooths everything over with Robert immediately.
And again, this is another one of those moments where I just clutch at my mouth. Like, I don't know why it's even worse when a dog does it, but I have this image, like, because a dog doesn't just pull a rope. A dog, like, worries a rope. It, like, grabs it and wags it back and forth in its head. And I have this image of it just pulling Henry's teeth back and forth in his mouth until they just rip out. A lot of dental trauma, like, in this book that just hits me right in my, like, right in my, like, solar plexus. Like, I just feel it, like, right there. But in any case, it works. The kids think it's great. Henry can shoot water out of the holes in his mouth. And we just had a completely pointless couple of chapters that had no bearing on the rest of this book.
Right.
Because we immediately skip a couple of months, or we're into the school year now.
One thing I like is the next chapter, Ramona and the PTA, starts with Henry riding his bike. And again, Lewis Darling showing that he's on the ball, has him riding exactly the same bike that he purchased in the last Henry Huggins book. And I as a kid, I liked this. I liked this sort of the sense that there was this progression that went on. Like in this book, Henry got a bike and here it is again. And later, Henry got a paper route, and that will become important in another story after that. Now, this one is another comedic one, but it does tie in with the concern about whether Ribsy is going to misbehave in a way that's going to get him in more trouble than he can ever get out of.
It's got a clever conceit behind it. Ramona is a catalyst in it, and she's more than just there to create trouble. Like you learn a lot about Ramona's psychology in this book, right. in this chapter. And as weird as the storyline is, I think that this is one of my favorite Henry Huggins chapters so far, because it's a bizarre little story with a bizarre central conflict.
Ramona and Beezus show up at Henry's house. Beezus wants to play checkers. This is a motivating factor in Henry and Beezus, as you remember, and it's brought up again in Beezus and Ramona that Beezus is good at checkers, and that Henry admires this in Beezus because she makes her moves quickly, not like other girls. Again, there's some odd gender stuff here, but I was a little bit more forgiving in this time because there's a point where Henry talks about how Beezus strikes him as sensible, and I realize that what he's really saying is that Beezus is interested in finding solutions.
Beverly Cleary would never go so far as to have, in these books, as to have one character get a crush on another character. But this is the closest. You sense she's edging towards that. There's a mutual respect between the two characters that might grow into something greater as they got older.
Ramona has a lunchbox with her that she's pretending to be a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And she
is messily eating an ice cream cone.
She's messily eating an ice cream cone. And she tries to take a picture with her camera, and she drops her ice cream cone. And Ribsy, of course, eats it immediately.
She didn't let the ice cream cone fall. That's the thing. Ribsy knocked it out of her hand. Yeah, he waits until she's not paying attention. The ice cream cone tips, and it says, with one sweep of his long pink tongue, he knocked Ramona's ice cream cone to the porch. So he is culpable in this.
Henry offers to buy a new ice cream cone, but that's not enough for Ramona. She wants a bit of revenge. So she suddenly snatches up one of Ribsy's bones and sticks it into her lunchbox and announces now that the lunchbox, which was a camera, is now a lunchbox, but the bone is now a sandwich.
And she climbs to the top of a jungle gym to get away from Ribsy.
Now, she's been crying over her ice cream cone, and Ribsy has been following her as they walk out to try and buy a new ice cream cone, and she climbs to the top of a jungle gym. Actually, they're passing the school, and Beezus mentions that there's a PTA meeting.
Yeah, it's the school playground.
Right. And Ramona announces that she wants some PTA.
Right. So they're going to buy her an ice cream cone. Ramona suddenly says she wants a PTA, and the kids are befuddled as to what she means by this. Now, here's the part that I find incredibly clever, mostly because I have a five-year-old who was recently a four-year-old, and this is it strikes me as so brilliantly true as to what the mind of a child this age is like. At Ramona's house, whenever the family is discussing a treat that they don't want Ramona to know they're discussing, like candy or Coke, and I like those are the two examples, Coke and candy, they will spell it out, C-O-K-E-C-A-N-D-Y. And Ramona's smart enough to figure it out that whenever anyone spells anything, they're discussing something that she would want to eat but that they don't want her to have. So when they say PTA, she assumes they're discussing a food, and no amount of explanation will satisfy this shrill child.
So she's up on the jungle gym. If you look at the Lewis Darling illustration, it's one of those incredibly dangerous aluminum tube jungle gyms that we had when we were kids, that you would climb up to a height of about 7 or 8 feet above the ground, and the ground was inevitably asphalt. And I don't know how we survived as kids.
Well, if you look at the new illustrations, it's still an aluminum jungle gym, but it is surrounded by soft grass, and Ramona's not terribly high off the ground.
So she's up there bawling away about wanting PTA. Ribsy is underneath her because he wants that bone back,
mm-hmm.
and the PTA meeting lets out. And a bunch of middle-aged women swarm out and find Ramona on top of the jungle gym, and they assume that she has been chased up there by Ribsy.
Yeah, and primarily it's Mrs. Wisser and some unnamed woman who are the kind of leading this mob against Ribsy. And things get out of hand pretty quickly with the women's assumptions. They won't listen to the children's explanation as to what's actually happening. They assume that Ribsy's a vicious dog. They figure out that it's Henry's dog and that this is the dog they heard bit the garbage man. And talk turns to calling the pound. Talk eventually turns to calling the police. And Henry is scared for the fate of his dog.
In walks Miss Mullen, the principal. Mm-hmm. Although she's another older woman, she is incredibly understanding. She says she's been watching Ribsy for some time and that he's always been the best behaved dog. She's a Ribsy supporter, and she has a quiet authority that even Ramona respects.
Yeah.
She says, "I think it's time to get down now," and Ramona does get down.
Yeah, I really like her approach. You also find out that she has three dogs of her own, which totally surprises Henry. It humanizes his principal to a degree that he didn't think was possible, and I don't know. It just shows that she's a reasonable person who's on this kid's side.
Right. There's a funny moment when Mrs. Wisser will not accept that Ribsy was not responsible for Ramona's running up the jungle gym. And she squats down and asks Ramona, "Did the doggy frighten you?" And Ramona says, "No."
Oh, I love it, because once Ramona gets what she wants, she immediately calms down. She's a little animal in these books. And she's as much as under the sway of her desires and her appetites as Ribsy is. So watching the two of them go head to head, they're pretty much on equal footing in this book. And once Ribsy gets his bone, he just calms down, he relaxes. And once she gets her PTA, her potato chips, all the other conflicts go out the door.
We've come to the end of the book, and this book ends once again on another two-parter, which is the big fishing trip. September has come, and Henry's father is getting his waders, although he goes out in a boat, so I don't know why he needs waders. He's getting his waders, and Henry knows that that means he's going salmon fishing. And at first, Henry wants Ribsy to go, and Mr. Huggins is going to do the reasonable thing and leave Ribsy at home. But Mrs. Huggins says, if Henry's going, Ribsy's going too, because I need a day off. In some ways, the final two chapters are all Mrs. Huggins' fault.
Right. In the final two chapters, I would love to know what's going on at the Huggins household during these final two chapters. I guarantee it does not involve anything fish-related or horse meat-related.
I just picture Mrs. Huggins day drunk on martinis.
Well, I love these two chapters because there's a different tone to them than the rest of the books. I think partially because it's Henry and adults who kind of just have to be adults. And Ribsy's very much a dog in these final two chapters. Doesn't get up to shenanigans, just basically acts like a dog would act. And I appreciate that Henry is really uncomfortable for most of these two chapters. Like they're squirm-inducing in a way that I recognize from childhood, where you've gotten yourself into a situation that you were really looking forward to, and it immediately becomes clear that this whole thing isn't going to live up to your expectations. It's that once they get out fishing, Henry is not happy with what fishing turns out to be, which is a lot, like you said, a lot of sitting and waiting in the rain. I like that reality check that I think kids recognize in the situation.
It's not simply these two adults he's out in the boat with, but Henry is being ushered into a completely different world. He's taken to the bait and tackle shop. He's taken to where they rent the boat to go out. He's surrounded by other men, and it seems important to him. You know, it seems like this is an initiation of sorts for him. But as you say, it's not what he's expecting. He's expecting glory. He's expecting this to be something more easy to like. But the joys of fishing, if you find fishing at all enjoyable, lie in things that are antithetical to the childhood experience. It's very slow. It's patient. It's contemplative. It's enduring. And that's not what he's looking for. And that's certainly not what Ribsy's looking for.
Well, and the discomfort comes ultimately from the fact that Henry realizes that his presence and Ribsy's presence are making Mr. Grumby and his father, to an extent, unhappy. Like, he realizes that he doesn't fit in there. What happens in this chapter in an earlier book could easily have turned into a comedy, where Ribsy's just constantly knocking things over in the boat, and it could have been like an episode of the old Dennis the Menace sitcom, where it's like, ah, that dog! Instead, what happens is Ribsy's uncomfortable in the boat and is acting like a dog, where he keeps trying to turn around and get comfortable, and he's knocking things over. It's played more for discomfort and making Henry feel less and less like he wants to be in this boat.
Again, as an adult reading this through, I have an enormous amount of sympathy for Mr. Grumby, which I didn't have as a kid, because when Henry shows up, the first thing that Mr. Grumby says is, "So you're going with us." For Mr. Grumby, what he's looking for is being alone or being with Mr. Huggins in silence, and he's really into that fishing experience. He's not interested in trying to explain anything to a child. He's doing his best, I think. You know, Mr. Grumby, as a kid, I always saw Mr. Grumby as this not villain, but certainly the foil for Henry. Mm-hmm. And here I see that Mr. Grimley is actually doing his best to keep his cool.
Yeah, I really admire, because he was set up as kind of the Mr. Wilson of the right. of the series. Like, and here we see a guy who, he's really being fair. Like, he's not going to yell at his neighbor's kid in front of, like, he's not going to do anything to make the situation worse. He's just going to bear it stoically, right, as well as he can.
And to be fair, Ribsy really does screw things up in a major way. I mean, he, first of all, knocks over the tackle box, and worse, Mr. Grumby is landing a large salmon, and when the salmon gets into the boat, Ribsy just freaks out.
As a dog would.
I mean, this is a big, like, 25-pound ball of muscle and teeth flopping around in the bottom of the boat. It's interesting to me that they talk about Mr. Huggins reaching for a club to club it. I never did that with fishing.
Well, I do know that my father once caught a fish. Well, I'll save it for the next chapter because it's very similar to what happened with Henry Huggins. I will say that it involves a club.
So not only does Ribsy jumping around the place allow the salmon to escape the boat, much to Mr. Grumby's consternation, but Ribsy jumps over the side of the boat and into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly this becomes extremely serious. I think it's a remarkable thing in a book that's so light and so comedic. There's a real danger here for Ribsy. They've been fishing basically at the mouth of a river between two sandbars, and Ribsy could be pulled out to sea by the current.
And they definitely let you know that as a reader. Like, this isn't anything you have to figure out later on. Like, Henry realizes that his dog could be killed in right. this chapter. And yeah, again, this could be played for laughs. It could be that wacky dog, but instead it's, oh no, Ribsy fell overboard. Will someone please help me save my dog?
Yeah.
And fortunately, well, another fisherman does.
I didn't remember this from reading this as a kid, but reading it now, the description is that there are just the mouth of this river is just awash with people in boats. You know, they're all at sort of respectable different distances from one another. I didn't remember that from being a kid. I always pictured them out there alone.
Mm.
But that's just my faulty memory, or maybe as a kid I was too anxious reading these last two chapters and I just skipped over a lot
it
of pages.
Is anxiety producing.
But yeah, another fisherman pulls out a gaff and hooks Ribsy. You know, earlier when they almost land Mr. Grumby's salmon, Mr. Huggins uses a gaff to catch it in the gills, and I just can't imagine doing that. That's how do you do that with a flailing salmon?
Much like the teeth pulling in the previous chapters, whenever they talk about hooking a fish's gills, or in the next chapter grabbing a fish's gills, it just makes me squirm. I know it probably doesn't hurt the fish as much as I imagine it does, but I'm just so squirmy about soft tissue that this book is just pushing all my buttons. But he hooks the back of Ribsy's collar, brings him into the boat, and you sort of get this moment where the dad's like, let's take the dog back to shore. And Henry understands that his father is saying, we're taking both of you back to shore, and you're not getting back on this boat.
Right.
And it's really a moment, because Henry's father and Mr. Grumby go back out, and Henry's just left at the shack, at the bait shop and the little, like, diner with his dog, his wet dog.
Right. The wet dog that everyone around starts to comment on how bad wet dogs smell.
Yeah, it becomes this thing. Like, he basically gets shamed out of this building.
He spies Scooter McCarthy's dad's car, and he doesn't want to run into Scooter here to show off his shame. So he and Ribsy go wandering off the side of the river, between the river and the ocean shore. And it's quite idyllic here. It's a beautiful sequence. And there's, an incredibly beautiful picture by Lewis Darling of them running across the shore that is a two-page spread. And it just stuck in my head as a kid. At this point in her career, Cleary is becoming a real master of modulating tone.
Mm.
I think that she moves from comedy to menace to the sense of shame, and everything flows very beautifully.
These two chapters just really stand out as an example of her writing, like, really maturing at this point. So the title of this final chapter is Henry's Adventure. And he does have quite the adventure coming up, in that he sees a salmon that's in the shallows and is trying to get back to the river.
Right. It's caught in a bit of water that has been disconnected from the river by a sandbar.
Yeah.
And so it's basically in about maybe a foot or 2 feet of water.
I mean, it strikes me as a bit of a plot contrivance that he would, you know, be dreaming of catching a salmon, have his dreams thwarted by this dog, and then suddenly just run into a salmon. But Cleary manages to present it as enough of a challenge that I forgive the lucky coincidence of the appearance of the salmon, because she really makes Henry work for it. In that he doesn't just, like, he wrestles a wild salmon.
Henry made up his mind he was not going to lose that fish. He flung his rain hat and coat and jacket onto the sand. "I'll tackle him. That's what I'll do," he thought grimly. "I've got to look out for those teeth, but maybe I can grab him by the gills." While Ribsy continued to bark wildly, Henry took a deep breath and flung himself onto the salmon. The icy water splashed in his face and soaked through his clothes as he gritted his teeth and hugged the big, slippery fish. With one powerful lunge, it twisted out of Henry's arms and tried to fight its way through water too shallow to swim in. Dripping with water and covered with fish scales, Henry got to his feet. "If I can just get him onto the sand," he thought, "maybe I can sit on him." Once more he flung himself onto the fish, and once more the salmon fought free and landed in still shallower water. "That's it," thought Henry. "I'll keep pushing him upstream." The next time he threw himself down, he managed to get one hand into the salmon's gills, which were rough and gave him something to hang on to. Henry dug in with his knees and hung on. "I think I've got him," he thought. This time the salmon didn't get away. "I have got him, but now what'll I do?" thought Henry desperately. "If I stand up and try to pick him up, he'll get away." The weary salmon struggled. Grimly, Henry held on. His hands were numb, and the stream flowing around him felt freezing cold. "What'll I do?" he thought. "I can't hang on much longer." Ribsy was running in circles, barking so hard he sounded hoarse. Henry could feel his grip on the fish's gills begin to slip. "He's getting away," he thought miserably. "I'll never be able to land him." "Hang on!" someone yelled. Out of the corner of his eye, Henry could see a man standing on the edge of the stream. Then the man disappeared. "Why did he go away?" Henry wondered. "Why didn't he help me?" But in a moment, the man reappeared with a piece of driftwood in his hand. He waded into the stream and quickly clubbed the salmon. The fish gave one mighty flop and was still. Dripping and shivering, Henry struggled to his feet with his salmon in his arms. It was his. He had caught a Chinook.
These fish are no joke. They can really bite you pretty mm-hmm. bad. I fished for pike, and my older brother Rob, one summer, he stuck his hand into a pike's mouth that he thought was dead, and the pike bit down on him really hard and bit right through his thumb. And he had like a puncture right through his thumbnail. And that was just a pike. This is a much bigger fish that we're dealing with here.
Well, fortunately, a man comes along.
Right.
And brings a club and clubs the salmon. So my story that really quick is that sort of told, my dad has told a couple of times. And it's one of those things that in my mind, I'm like, did this really happen? But my dad talks about how he was once basically in the same situation. He had his car and he just saw I don't know if it was a salmon. I don't know where he was. It was a fish, a large fish caught in the shallows by a river. And now he tried to wrestle it because he was like, free fish. And how he tried to wrestle it into the car and he couldn't get it in. So he ran back and I think he grabbed like a tire iron and he clubbed the fish until it stopped moving. And he threw it in the back of his car and took off driving. And of course, as luck would have it, of course, it woke back up. And then he had this huge fish thrashing around in the back of his car. Now, again, don't know if this is a true story. Don't know if I'm remembering the details correctly. But it's the story that always stuck with me when I read this chapter and thought, yeah, this could happen because I know it at least theoretically happened in real life. Yeah. He wraps the fish in his raincoat or in something and he carries it. The man carries it back to the boathouse for him.
But then he gets the honor of carrying it into the boathouse and they weigh it. His dad and Mr. Grumby show up. Fortunately, Mr. Grumby has caught another fish.
Yes.
So Scooter and his dad show up. Scooter notably does not have a fish. Poor Scooter, you know, he gets kind of humiliated in this book.
Yeah, Scooter didn't really do anything wrong. Like, he's a little bit of a jerk, but he really gets shown up here at the end. Because everyone's talking about this kid who tackled a fish with his bare hands.
Yeah, it turns out to be 29 pounds. So, and there Henry gets a picture taken, and it ends on this note of Henry and his dad carrying the fish back and singing the Wolfie's Dog Food song. Uh-huh. Again, I feel like Cleary wants to be more meaningful than I can figure out what it's supposed to mean. I guess it's supposed to mean that Ribsy really is a member of the family. I don't know.
I guess she does TV jingles to a much more effective, puts them to much better use in the later Ramona series. You'll hear these jingles as refrains, thematic refrains that mean a lot to the characters, but they fit in a lot better with what the characters are going for. I think she's playing around with more complex storytelling in this. Like, she's trying things out that aren't quite clicking yet, that she's going to be able to use in her later books to better effect. Because I think she's trying to say that, like, when things are good with Ribsy, Henry sings this song, maybe.
Well, I think another thing that happens is that Cleary has these emotional moments in her stories that are that as an adult I recognize as sort of epiphanal moments for characters or moments that are sort of transcendent, but because of the kind of writer she is, she will never have a sequence where Henry thinks, I will always remember this moment as long as I live. So instead, what she has are these kinds of oblique ways of underscoring the importance of a moment. And I think that she's trying that out here. It becomes so much more effective in the Ramona books, where we do have these moments where Ramona has a moment where she understands Beezus, or she understands her mother, or she understands her father in a way that she didn't before. But Cleary is too good a writer to be sentimental about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to repeat what I said at the beginning. So, I mean, that's, like you said, that's the way the story ends, is it just ends with him and his father with the fish singing a theme song. And, but I want to repeat that I think that Henry and Ribsy is our first real example of Beverly Cleary successfully navigating her way through a novel, setting up and telling a complete story. She's kind of done it. Like, we've had goals that have gone through these books in the past. Henry trying to get a new bike, Otis was trying to do. I can't even remember. Like, characters have goals. It was hinted at a lot with Ellen Tebbets, but that was even more episodic. This is the first time I think she's really just committed to Henry pursuing a goal that then has a bigger payoff than we'd anticipated. Like, the end isn't, yay, I get to go fishing. It's he gets his prize, and then he learns something else beyond that. Like, he experiences the fishing trip and it carries him even deeper into into his development, into his growth, into his learning what it means to be, like, his responsibility, and his learning more about his dad and about adults, and growing up a little bit.
It's interesting that this is where Henry gets left for a little bit. Cleary is going to move on to give Beezus her turn in the spotlight, and then she's going to go through some other books. It's kind of poignant to imagine a child of the 50s picking up this book and setting it down, and that being the last they see of Henry for a while.
Yeah, I guess it's not too long now. She does two books, and then she returns to Henry.
Well, she also does in between a bunch of... she does her picture books.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We've got some stuff she does for younger readers as well.
And I do think that when we pick up with Henry again, I have a feeling that the next two books felt qualitatively different to me. And I'm curious to know when I read them again whether I still feel that way.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how, because she starts writing for older kids as well. She tries her hand at writing for older children and like teenagers, and she tries her hand at writing for younger children. And I'm curious to see in the future, A, how that informs her return to these characters she's already written, and also how the character of Ramona becomes more... I have a feeling that Beverly Cleary intended to make Beezus the focus of her next major offshoot series, and that Ramona was an insidious presence who just worked her way into the spotlight. Like, I'm curious to see where that happens, where Ramona starts becoming a fully fledged character that wants to have a book written about her.
Well, stay tuned, dear listeners.
We'll find out.
Click It Cast is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. For more smart, funny podcasts, visit theincomparable.com.